Welcome back to another episode of the Expert Witness Playbook. I'm your host, Dr. Brian Woodruff. Today's guest is Elizabeth McKinney, a forensic speech and language pathologist and the owner of Forensic SLP Consulting Services. Liz has 18 years of clinical experience as a speech and language pathologist with specialized expertise in dysphagia, neurologic disease, dementia, and swallowing disorders. She has been retained in more than 30 plaintiff and defense matters involving issues such as aspiration, choking, swallowing injuries, neurologic injury, and developmental disorders. And I think today's conversation is going to be particularly interesting because when most people hear speech and language pathologists, they think about speech and communications issues. They probably don't immediately think about swallowing, aspiration, choking deaths, or expert witness testimony. We're going to talk to Liz about her journey from clinical practice into forensic work, what an SLP can bring to a legal case, how she evaluates these cases, and some of the lessons she has learned building an expert witness practice. Liz, welcome to the Expert Witness Playbook. I'm glad you're joining. Yeah, this is great. I think, you know, we've not had a speech and language pathologist on the show yet, on the podcast. And so this is going to be great. When I heard about your specialty, I've actually been involved in cases similar to what you've described, sort of choking issues and things. But I think let's start with your background. How did you become a speech and language pathologist? And what did your career look like before you got involved in expert work?
Did my 4 years undergrad and then decided to go to grad school there as well. I did undergrad, grad school at University of Florida. And then I did my externship and my clinical fellowship year down here in Florida. And I've just been down here ever since, working in nursing homes. So I absolutely love what I do.
So you have a master's level education. Is that yes, what you have in speech and language pathology? Mm-hmm. Okay. And then has sort of the swallowing and dysphagia been part of your work all along, or is that sort of a newer part of it?
That is really the meat and potatoes of what a geriatric speech pathologist does. We can either, you know, as a speech pathologist, you can work with children or with adults. So with children, that's more in the schools with articulation, just language development. But then on the adult side, that's, you know, the people with the neurological injury, with the strokes, with the Parkinson's disease, with the dementia. So we do a lot of language retraining after a stroke. But a lot, most of what I do in the nursing home is swallowing therapy.
Kind of evaluating people, seeing if they're safe to swallow, seeing what textures. I know I've sat in on a few sort of bedside sort of swallow evaluations and things. So when did you become interested in expert work? How did that come about?
Yeah, well, I really had no idea what it was. I didn't know it existed. One of my colleagues, she was actually a colleague of my husband's, and she contacted my husband asking if, because she knows I was a speech therapist, and she asked if I would be interested in doing a review of a case in Washington State, actually. And I'm in Florida, so this is all alien to me at the time. I received the documents and I reviewed everything and I fell in love. You know, I wrote a good report. I did a good verbal review, and the case settled after my report was brought to arbitration. So, then a side gig was born.
So how long ago was that? Was that first case?
That was in August, 2023.
Okay. So about 3 years ago, you've been doing this at the very beginning. That's how most people kind of come into this, I've found, is they just, somebody asks them about it, they have no clue, they kind of dive in, and then after the fact, they're like, oh, this is pretty cool. Let's figure out how to do this better, you know? Exactly. And And so obviously you've had a lot of cases you've had a chance to review. And what have you done to sort of get the word out there that you're available? A lot of people listening, that's sort of their big thing. They may not have even had a case, or they've had one or two cases. And a lot of people are really interested in how do I get attorneys or people that are making the decision of who to retain? How do I get to be known?
Well, I have made a humongous LinkedIn presence. When I was first starting out, I met this a man named Sheikh Ali.
Oh, Sheikh. He
Yeah,
usually comes up
Sheikh.
on every episode. Sheikh is the master of LinkedIn. He obviously, for those listeners, if you want to learn about LinkedIn, you go to Sheikh.
Yeah. So he really helped me to build my brand, to, come up with an outreach program. I also connected with a lot of legal nurse consultants in the beginning. One of the first things I did was join AALNC, the American Association of Legal Nurse Consultants. And I went to some in-person meetings. I saw you at the forum, just to get to know everybody. And the legal nurse consultants are the people on the case that see it first, and they
Absolutely.
determine what experts are needed.
And they're often, yeah,
I
for
really
those
got
that are
mine.
listening, they're often the people that are helping the attorneys make decisions about experts. Like you said, what experts are needed, or maybe even pointing them toward an expert. So the legal nurse consultant groups are they are they're so important to connect with. Because they're the front lines. They're kind of the front line. They're the infantry of both plaintiff and defense cases. And so you've made sort of a presence on LinkedIn. You've connected, and both in person, that making connections with people is really important. Have you done anything else? Any other are you on any directories or webs? Do you have a website? Those sorts of things.
Don't have a website. I just have a LinkedIn profile, but I'm on the SEEK directory. I took the SEEK expert witness training, and so I'm the SEEK directory as also. That was really enlightening to learn, what you should talk about, what you shouldn't talk about when you're working on a case.
So the SEEK, yeah, a lot of people talk about they've taken that and done the course. Do you remember which course you did?
The expert witness course. I don't. I'm not sure which one
Kind
it
of
was.
it goes through the nuts and bolts from beginning to end.
It had several modules. So
Yeah. Was it, did you do it in person or virtual?
virtual.
Did virtual. Okay.
Yeah,
What
no.
did you, I guess, what were the biggest, do you remember back, like the biggest surprises? Like, oh gosh, I would never have thought of that. Like, what were some of the nuggets of like, I'm really glad that I learned this because I would never have thought of that.
Something that kind of surprised me was that if you are a standard of care expert, that you really shouldn't go over into the causation side of things. Especially me, I'm not a physician, so the causation should be up to the physician. And so I can't be lassoed in as both a causation expert and a standard of care expert. And that's been a hard one for me. Because, if you see what happened in the case, the patient died, then, and it was because of choking, then that's the causation, but you can't say that.
Right, because that's more of a medical diagnosis, right? And that we've talked a lot about staying in your lane, right? And a lot of the previous episodes, we talked a lot about how you can lose credibility. You can have what your main thing you're talking about is solid. You've got the clinical expertise. You've got all the data behind it, and then people veer into something that is not within, and their credibility, They think that they're doing the right thing, but they're really not. They're getting into an area where they really don't have the expertise. Maybe it just makes common sense, right? This patient had a piece of a hot dog that was not cut up sufficiently, or they shouldn't have had that food based on. They choke. There is a choking episode. They go into respiratory arrest. They go into cardiac arrest. They're coded. EMS comes. They pull a chunk of hot dog out of their airway. The patient ultimately is coded more and is pronounced dead at the scene. I mean, it seems like common sense. They were awake and alert, 15 minutes before or however long they ate this. There's a hot dog in the airway, but that's for somebody else. Everybody has to figure out where the link in the chain that they where they need to be and stay right there.
I think you've been reading my case files. That's almost exactly a case that I have reviewed.
Well, I haven't read any of your case files. I have just been involved in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases. I mean, this has even come up in the pediatric population. I reviewed a case. It never went to deposition of there was a teenager who actually was living in a nursing home and choked to death on a piece of a hot dog that wasn't properly cut up. I can't remember if she wasn't supposed to have a hot dog or if it wasn't cut up, and they could prove, like, when they removed the piece of hot dog, how big it was, because she didn't chew it. It just lodged in her airway. So they could prove how big the piece of food was. And so we've seen some similar. So I would be the causation person. You know what I mean? But I can't say, oh, they should have, that would be improper for me to go over and say, hey, they should have not given her that hot dog. I have no expertise in that. So I've got a quick question. So why don't you have a website? Is it just you haven't needed it or didn't want it or sort of? Okay.
Gotten around to it.
Yeah, no, I haven't. Some people feel like, oh, I don't want to have a website. For reasons of, being asked about it, and other people are just like, hey, I'm busy enough. I don't need that extra expense.
Just haven't really had need for it. I
Awesome.
mean, I will in the future, I guess, because I'll be doing this for a long time, but.
Well, great. So I suspect many attorneys and even physicians don't fully appreciate the role of speech and language pathology in swallowing. So give us sort of some scenarios where speech and language fits into the case. I mean, we talked about sort of swallowing. What sort of opinions are you able to provide as a speech and language pathologist?
So if a case comes on my desk, and they, let's say it was a person who, let's go with your hot dog. So a person with like developmental disability, who was seen by a speech pathologist on admission. The speech pathologist just did a screen and decided that he needed, an evaluation for therapy. And then the speech pathologist, recommended a certain diet for him. So, she recommended maybe, there are different ways to classify a diet. So he could be on mechanical soft, or he could be on minced and moist. Those are both kind of they're talking about the same type of diet. But that's another layer of these cases is, how the diet was documented, how it was communicated. So let's say he was on a recommended diet of mechanical soft solids. And that means that the meat should be ground up. And then there is a facility picnic, or something, and he receives a full hot dog. And he's not supposed to receive that, but it falls short somewhere. The communication, the carryover falls short somewhere. Let's say he has the speech pathologist recommended a certain supervision level. He's left alone with it. So, and he chokes, and he can't be resuscitated. So we're looking at where the breakdown is, because the speech pathologist did everything correctly. She did the evaluation. She recommended the correct diet. She recommended the correct supervision level. But then, so where's the break? Where does it fall down? And it was in the supervision.
So that would fall probably outside of the speech and language pathology because it would be like a nursing home supervision deficit, right? Kind of more of a, I could see bringing in like a nursing home expert on supervision. Are there cases where you have to give opinions on they didn't pick the right diet to begin with? Like you can they say you go into the case and say there is no way this patient should have been on that diet, and they should have been on a thickened liquid diet, but they were getting liquids. Like how do you after the fact, like how would you go and figure that out, like without actually evaluating, you don't have a patient to evaluate. How do you figure out from the records what the diet should have been without being able to evaluate the patient?
Well, if you see a patient who is severely cognitively impaired, severe dementia, and they're like in the end stages where they're not talking anymore, or where they're, not, they're having all their needs anticipated. These are the patients that do not need to be on solid food diets. Because I've explained this before, but or not on this podcast, but before in other podcasts, but dementia is like aging in reverse. It's retrogenesis. So you have all the high level skills, and then you lose them in reverse order that you acquired them. So in the later stages of dementia, you really become a baby again. So you lose your chewing ability, you lose your ability to clear your mouth safely. And so it's these people that also have the nonverbal, that have basically turned into babies again. They should more likely than not be on a pureed texture or be on a altered texture. And when I see cases where the therapist has gone in and evaluated that they are at that level cognitively, but left them on a regular diet, that's a concern for me. I also recently, or not, re this is one of my old cases. A man who had a stroke, and he was evaluated and by the speech pathologist, and she only evaluated him for language, for aphasia, and for dysarthria. That's muscle weakness in the mouth that makes your speech unclear. But she did not look at him at all for swallowing. But that kind of is one of those moments where you kind of turn your head and say, really?
So that would be standard of care. If you see somebody that part of a proper evaluation is not only the speech and language, but the swallowing.
Exactly. When you get to
Okay.
this population where the swallowing is almost always involved. But this man was not evaluated for swallowing, and he couldn't tolerate his diet. He couldn't chew it. He couldn't clear it. And he didn't choke, but he lost a very significant amount of weight, to the point of malnutrition, dehydration, failure to thrive came in. He just continued to deteriorate. He had wounds that could not heal because he didn't have the correct nutrition.
Oh, wow.
So it's just the small things that are overlooked can it can be a snowball effect and cause a lot of other problems.
So, we're talking about sort of airway and aspiration things. Can you explain what actually happens when somebody aspirates and why silent aspirations can be particularly dangerous?
Well, because you're a physician, but the airway, the trachea, and the esophagus, the food tube, are right next to each other. And when a person swallows, that whole complex elevates, and there's a little flap that covers up the airway and it sends all the food down the right way, down the esophagus. Now, sometimes because of timing being off, because of strength being off, because of coordination being off, food or liquid can go into the trachea, into the airway. And you have at the top of your airway, you have your vocal cords, which are little pieces of muscle, that vibrate to make sound when air is blown up through them. So when anything touches those vocal folds, a person with normal sensation would start coughing their head off.
Right.
They would clear their throat trying to get rid of it. But a person who has decreased sensation because of something like advanced dementia or like a stroke or a person who's just had a breathing tube taken out, their sensation is affected. So these people can have liquid go down below the level of the vocal cords. And after it goes down below, it's a straight shot to the lower lungs, to the lower lobes. And if this happens a little bit at a time for an extended period of time, then what can develop but aspiration pneumonia, and bacteria.
Yeah, I mean,
So,
obviously your mouth is dirty and things coming up would that would not be good for your lungs. So when you receive a case, sort of what are the things you're obviously you get questions asked and you want to answer those, but when you receive a case, sort of what records are the most important to you and what are you usually looking at in a case?
So I always want to, of course, have the speech pathology notes because that's the standard of care that I'm looking at. But I'm also looking at, the carryover of the orders, how it transpired at the facility. So I want to see the nursing notes, the CNA documentation, the nursing assistant documentation. I also like to look at the EMT call log, the call sheet. Because when the EMTs get there after the code blue is called and the 911 is called and they actually come to the scene, they see and they report a different picture sometimes than you see from the nursing notes. So I always like to have that. I like to look at the certificate of death, see what was the actual thing that killed them. What it was attributed to. I think,
Yeah, that
and the
seems
medical records. I like to kind of reconstruct their past medical history.
right. How do you separate out sort of, this is the question that we all have, but for you as a speech and language pathologist, how do you separate out a true breach in the standard of care from just an unfortunate outcome? Like what do you base standard of care on? And how do you sort of separate those two?
The standard of care for speech pathologists, from personal experience, from training, I can take that. But there's also the ASHA preferred practices. That's the American Speech and Hearing Association. We have documents and we have lots of rules and regulations on our website that you can decide about. But basically, if a person has a dysphagia, you want to evaluate that. And you want to recommend a diet and you want to educate. I'm always looking for those three things.
Awesome.
And
But yeah, let's shift gears more to sort of the expert witness side as far as kind of how you practice. So obviously you've reviewed cases for both plaintiff and defendants. And when you open a file, how do you keep yourself from being influenced by which side retains you? Sort of what techniques do you use so you stay objective?
I always start at the end, what happened to the patient. And then I kind of move backwards. And I look at the same things no matter where I'm looking. I'm always digging to see, if the nurses did the right thing, if the speech pathologist did the right thing. And sometimes I've found that everything was done correctly. And I've had cases, plaintiff cases actually, where, in our verbal review, the first thing I say is the speech pathologist was fine here. She wasn't in error at all. And that's kind of, I just objectively look at things. And I try to put myself in the position of where that speech pathologist was at that point in time. What she knew, how she was making her decisions.
Yeah. I've talked about this in the past, but telling an attorney no is one of the more difficult things we can do. And my technique is I come right out of the gate and say, I'm not going to be able to support your case. That's the first thing. And I let and then I pause for a second or two, and then I get into, what are the reasons? I don't like to start just talking about the case. Like they need to know that right from the start. That's the, you got to rip that Band-Aid off. I think that's the best technique. And don't get talked, once you know it's not a good case, I tell people, do not get talked into, I've heard these horror stories where they get talked back into a case, and then that never ends well. Yeah. As far as you've been retained a lot, what is something, after you've done all these cases, what is something that you wish somebody had told you from the beginning, like either about, doing reports or working with attorneys? What's something you've kind of learned on the job that would be helpful to people in any expert sort of field? That you think they should know. And
Biggest thing is that attorneys are people. They're just like us. I was so intimidated at the beginning to be speaking to these big fancy attorneys, but they're just people. And just treat them with kindness, treat them like people. Kind of for my reports, I have developed a kind of a template, where you talk in your report, you kind of introduce the case, and then you have a section like what your task is, what you're supposed to be doing. And or before that, I think, I just always introduce myself and you list my credentials, and then I have a section about the prior expert experience. And then, what you're tasked to do, and then the background of the case, and then your opinions. So just separating a report into sections rather than just rambling on for 24 pages,
exactly. Being
just kind of separate it out. That's
very
kind of helped me out along
organized.
the way.
And I think adding to that, a section of what you reviewed, I always list
Oh, yes.
records reviewed. Yeah.
Yep, that's
But
one of the first ones.
what you've been asked to do, what was your what you were asked to do, or asked to review, your background. Yeah. I think that's those are really good. Staying organized and keeping it at a level that that an attorney can understand. So what do you see as the biggest mistakes attorneys make when they're handling a swallowing, aspiration, or choking case? Where do they mix things up, or what do they seem to repeatedly get wrong?
I think really not involving a speech pathologist would be a pretty big mistake. I think if it's a choking case, you should always have an SLP look at it, for standard of care for the speech side. But not only can I opine on standard of care for speech, I can also opine for like the carryover in the nursing home or in the hospital, because that's part of what I'm involved in as well.
Right.
But I think that would be the big thing, just not bringing in the correct experts. Because speech pathologist experts are few and far between. There aren't many of us. So
So obviously you've built a niche that is needed. That's what it's so interesting how people sort of carve out these very interesting niches within expert work. I mean, anything that can be litigated needs an expert. And I've met equine evaluation experts and all kinds of fun things where you're like, you have to give the value of a horse. Like, where does that come up? They're like, well, when a barn burns down and they lose, 30 horses and there's an insurance policy on all these horses. And I was like, oh my gosh. You know what I mean? It just it blows my mind every time I talk to every time I talk to different experts. Well, this has been super helpful. Is there anything, before we close out today, is there anything else that you think would be important for our listeners, attorneys, other experts to know about kind of being a speech and language pathology expert or just being an expert in general?
One of the biggest takeaways that with report writing is to create endnotes instead of listing in the report where you got it. Just create an endnotes, like 1A is a document with a certain page at the end,
Oh,
and
so
that
you're talking
makes
about
your books much easier to read.
footnoting and indexing where you got that. Yes, I think there are a lot of people that don't do that. I do that in my reports where I can actually find that data point and go back to the actual document and verify it. That there are not a lot of people doing that, and I strongly recommend because at deposition, if they say, "Well, where did you get that?" You're like, right here on page 72. And it's like right there. Like everything that's in your report, have it linked or able to get to the primary source because it often comes up questions of where did you get that? Yeah.
And it's much easier for the attorneys as well to, have an exact point to refer to.
And yeah, being able to verify everything is just so important. Well, Liz, this has been outstanding getting a chance to chat with you. And I really appreciate you taking time out to jump on here and tell us about this very interesting field and probably one that a lot of people didn't understand very well before today, but I think people understand it a lot better now.
Great. Thanks for having me.
For those of you out there listening to the Expert Witness Playbook, I say thank you. And if you get a moment, please take the time to like, comment, and subscribe. Those are the best things you can do to keep us going. Let us know what conversations you may want to have in the future. And if you are a an expert or somebody that's getting into the field and would like to be on the show, reach out to us. One of the things, Liz, how would somebody get in touch with you? What is your email address?
Email is E McKinney, so EMCKINNEY SLP at gmail.com.
Perfect.
And then,
And we'll have that up on the screen and people can get a hold of you. So until we meet again, thank you for everybody for listening.
Thank you.